Ryan Seacrest here. So every great barbecue takes a little patience. And while the food does its thing, you can enjoy a little Chumba Casino. The perfect recipe. Chumba Casino. Always good to have you back.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to another haunting installment of Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. I'm your host, Steve Taylor, and tonight's tale is a slow, spiraling descent into the private world of a long marriage and the invisible thresholds we sometimes cross in the name of love. Some stories of horror are loud and bloody, others unfold with quiet devotion in rooms you've lived in for decades, beside someone you've known longer than yourself. But what happens when one of you begins to believe in something beyond this world? And worse, when they might be right? Tonight's story is featured courtesy of Velox Books, a small press with an enormous appetite for horror. If you crave fiction that pushes the limits of imagination and reality, you'll want to hear more about them later in the show. We'll also tell you how to get your hands on one of the most praised collections in modern weird fiction. So stick around. Before we begin, a quick reminder. If our stories leave you staring too long out your own window, help keep the darkness alive. Leave us a 5-star review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your fix. Watching us on YouTube, give us a like, share your thoughts in the comments, and subscribe. Don't forget to ring that bell, or you might miss something important. Looking for more tales that blur the line between the real and the unreal? Visit ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com and become a patron. For just $7.99 a month or even less with an annual membership, you'll unlock early access, ad-free listening, and exclusive stories you won't find anywhere else. You'll also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and X, where the darkness never sleeps. Now, pour yourself a late-night drink, dim the lights, lean in close. This one's going to hurt. Tonight's story comes from acclaimed author J.R. Hamadashen and is featured courtesy of Velox Books, where horror festers, grows, and whispers just beneath the surface. In this tale, a woman recounts the final day she spent with her husband, a man convinced he was being called to another realm. What follows is a quiet horror that hides in the space between grief and belief, between doubt and devotion. Performed by Olivia Steele and featuring Jeff Sturtevant, this is No Hole in a Small World Can Truly Be a Small Hole by J.R. Hamadashen.
To be married to someone for a long time is to create a separate universe. Each marriage is similar only to the extent that people everywhere, I suppose, have common motivations and emotions. But to explain the dynamics of your marriage to anyone in any real way is impossible. The words make sense on paper, but the words are animated from beyond, from an endless well of lived experience, understood only within the universe of that marriage. Within your own marriage, it can make sense why you'd become angry when, for example, your husband pours out your water at night before you finish taking all of your pills. He probably assumed you left it out, even though, why would you leave out water that was half filled? It makes you wonder what he must think of you. Lazy, forgetful, and inconsiderate, because he's the one who makes the money and you let him do most of the cleaning because he likes to do it. And he thinks he's being considerate by pouring it out without asking you, as if that's something that he's contributing to the marriage, unfussily disposing of unnecessary items. And the internal critic asks, why make such a big deal out of it? Surely he didn't mean anything by it. But to give a full accounting for that answer would require you to go through the years of your marriage and lay out each and every little inconsiderate indignity that has led you to this moment, to explain to yourself why this all makes sense. But if you do that, you are shrill and unhinged, and fuck, maybe you are. Do you understand the point I'm trying to make? So life went on and I never really complained, so the perception built up that it was my increasingly gloomy husband who, as we crept along into advanced middle age, was the one who'd been suffering the most under the weight of life's accumulating privations. And maybe he had, actually, and I'd never noticed. Which is maybe what you're thinking, because here I am, the one explaining myself. It's no secret that I'm talking about what happened with Robert. And it's no secret that first impressions are largely unchangeable. It's like a playing field, split in the middle, with one side colored green for good and the other red for bad. Now Robert is on the bad side, based on how I just described him. I can tell you all the great things about him, how I fell in love with him, why I married him in the first place, how he's taken care of me, how he's always been faithful, even though what I admit were long sexual droughts, has always been a good financial provider to me and our two children, and all the other reasons, basically why I love him. All those explanations get me indulgent nods and comments about how things are complicated, and maybe that will, in your mind, claw him back some toward the center of that playing field. But the die has been cast and the impressions have been made. I'm the silently suffering, put-upon wife. He, the boorish brute. Perhaps ignorant of his own privilege, or a well-meaning brute, you think, but a brute, nonetheless. And when you begin to make impressions, let me just remind you of my analogy about marriage creating a separate universe, as clumsy as it might be. I think it gets to some essential point. We had a universe of two, and you're on the outside looking in. I'm trying to be honest as I can be, knowing still that the first impressions I gave are likely to remain. I regret how I began this and wish somehow that someone could look back over the course of our marriage, learn the laws and customs native to our private universe, and render fair, impartial judgment to provide me with some... I mean to say closure, but that's not the word. Our two adult children are grown and gone away. Amy, our oldest, lives 4 hours away. Aaron, just under 3. I felt guilty that we only had daughters, as all men want a son. Over 2 decades ago, we talked about a third, but my heart and body weren't in it. And while he never explicitly indicated as such, I wonder if he bore any resentment. Maybe that played a factor in what happened. No, I don't think so. But things like that, you just never know. I had noticed generally that he'd been keeping more to himself. He read alone without coming out to the couch and asking if I wanted to read alongside him. Or I'd come home and he'd be in the middle of a movie that I want to watch, whereas in our younger days he'd never start a movie he'd even conceivably suspected that I just, maybe, wanted to watch alongside him. Maybe he was just extremely considerate back in the day and I'm spoiled because who can maintain that? Or maybe he became too preoccupied with other things to give the subject much attention. In our advanced middle age, we've become sexless. which might be important to mention. But all couples become so, really. He didn't query, so to speak, and I don't know. I didn't feel the urge, honestly, and I didn't want to embarrass him, so that entire aspect of our lives lay dormant. Also, our health hadn't been great. We were both overweight, as you can tell with me, obviously. But for a woman, it just feels different. I feel disgusting, this dumpy garbage bag gut. Maybe that's where it all started. No, of course not. That's way too simple. Way too pedestrian. But what is a rational mind for if not to rationalize? Since our health wasn't great, we were watching what we ate. I always thought we ate pretty healthy by American standards, but my impression from the start was that the onus seemed to fall more on me because I cared more. To please me, he would eat more salads, chew slower, and avoid fried foods and desserts. He was always someone who seemed to want praise. And in the beginning, he'd call attention to his good habits, which could be charming, although it's dispiriting to think that the needy habits of our youth remain essentially unchanged. I did notice over the course of several months that he took pride in disciplining himself enough to stick with something. He was always someone who prized order and routine, the type who hates rowdy crowds or loud spaces. Not that I'm much different in that regard, and always at least aspired to maintain some type of discipline. Such as, he didn't like watching two movies in a row, thinking it was indulgent and undisciplined, like the greater balance of a night was being upset. Stupid things like that. He used to listen to podcasts about discipline and routine and working out, but what he ever did with any of it, I have no idea. He certainly wasn't working out to my knowledge. I wish I could say I know with certainty that we had the following exchange the night before everything went awry, but I can't be sure. It was close to it, at least. We hadn't eaten any dessert for some time at this point. Probably something like 6 months. I had more of a sweet tooth than he, and there used to be these chocolate fudge cookies made by Feinstein's that I used to just love. Robert turns to me one night while we're reading in bed and asks me,
"I was wondering something. Say the world was going to end in exactly 1 week from tonight, and we knew this. Would you still stick to our diet and avoid desserts?"
Why'd I bring up those Feinstein's cookies? He must have mentioned them. That's why. He must have said something like,
"Even those Feinstein's cookies you love so much?"
I thought about it, and when I became self-conscious about my failure to quickly respond, I said, "Hmm," as if that overt act of reflection reset my time to answer. "No, I think I'd have the cookies," I finally answered. Robert nodded solemnly. I'm not sure if this is just retroactive imagining, but I felt that question carried some importance and my answer was disappointing. Even worse, it was as if he expected my answer to be disappointing, and he lingered on me for a moment, as if reluctantly processing confirmation of that disappointment.
"See, I wouldn't. I'd stick with the pledge. I said I wouldn't eat any desserts, so I wouldn't,"
he said in an unadorned way that I know means he was proud of himself. All I could think was that it's a strange world where an atheist who has never articulated any belief in any objective meaning or higher power finds transcendent value in refraining from eating cookies. "You wouldn't want to eat cookies with me? With only a week to live? Cookies and fish food ice cream, a movie on the couch, maybe a classic and some nice drinks. Doesn't that sound lovely though?" I said it in a bubblier voice than usual, a bit faux wistfully, a voice I used when I was cuter, and which used to induce in my husband a masculine protective instinct to embrace and love me. He paused, half smiled, and said,
"When you put it like that, For you, I would.
And he touched my hand warmly, kissed the area of the blanket which covered my upper body, and turned over to his side. As we said our goodnights and turned off the light, I thought to myself, maybe he'd do as he said, but he wouldn't want to. He'd be disappointed. He made a promise and wanted to stick with it. The world ending would create the opportunity for him to be recognized as disciplined, even for something so petty. To him, that's still some kind of accomplishment. We often wake up at the same time. When one of us wakes up before the other wants to, we usually go back to sleep until our alarms, reset for the agreed-upon time, wakes us both up. The day after that dessert conversation, in my mind it was the following day, I'm not sure, but that's what I'm sticking with. It must have been, Saturday or Sunday, because he didn't go to work. I don't remember why, but I got out of bed before him. I was doing something insignificant in the living room, like reading a paper, holding out making breakfast until he woke up. That was it. It must have been breakfast, because I must have gotten hungry and went back in to ask him what he wanted, which also doubled as a way of waking him up. He was already up, and I remember first thing I saw was him in his white t-shirt and boxers from the night before, back toward me, crouched over and staring out the window. He had uncharacteristically opened the blinds. After waking up, he always first takes his pills, heads to the shower, or, if not showering that day, at least changes his clothes. But I recognized this t-shirt as the same one he wore the night before, because it had a little red pus stain on the back near his neck, from where he must have popped a swollen back pimple. I could see the folds at the back of his neck, the thinning grayish-brown crown that was the back of his head, and his knobby, pointy elbows, which seemed ill-proportioned given the supple, fatty thickness of his arms. I was thinking of making shakes. Want one? I can make it with frozen bananas in the freezer. I remember acting timidly, as if the unusual act of sleeping late, keeping his back toward me, and looking out a window in the morning suggested something disquieting. He wasn't a man who tended to look out windows, other than the sporadic observation about an unusually pleasing cloud, the type of rote comment that anyone might make. Turning slightly to signify my presence, but not enough for me to see him any better, he only said, politely and almost with a sense of guilt,
"I'm not hungry just now."
And before I moved or even responded, as if changing course, he asked,
"Could you please close the door?"
I didn't know if that meant with me in or out of the bedroom. Without turning around, he must have sensed this confusion because he quickly clarified,
"Please come in and close the door."
The obvious protest was that I was hungry and just wanted to get started making breakfast. His voice wasn't severe, and I didn't really expect him to drop any kind of bombshell on me. He wasn't that type of person. If history was any indication, he'd ask me to look at something on his body, convinced he'd found some kind of cancerous mark, which, thankfully, such marks had never amounted to anything. Or, perhaps at worst, tell me some minor remark or perceived personal failure of his that was making him distraught. "Are you okay, honey?" I asked as a matter of course. I don't want to give the impression I didn't care. Of course I did. But I do remember thinking that I was hungry. He likely was too, and we'd feel better after eating. I sat on the bed, facing his back. I noticed he still hadn't turned from the window, or given any indication he planned to. "Come sit with me, honey. What's bothering you?" I tried again.
"You know, I've always loved you so, so much. You've been the light of my life."
There were directions this could go. I was getting nervous from this ominous buildup, but also found myself a bit peeved, if I'm being honest, but in an anticipatory way. As if I knew this was going to be something of a deflating bit of deferment. Unless he'd been hiding a terminal diagnosis from me, unlikely since I knew every doctor's appointment he went to, there was just no way this could be as dire as he made it seem. We had aged out of the instability that allowed for betrayals and secrets. I just wished whatever this was, we could resolve it swiftly and eat breakfast. Honey, what is this about? Such a question is inherently direct, but my tone was, I hoped, gently accommodating. He shifted his weight slightly. I saw his shoulders rise and fall as if swallowing a great load of air, and he fidgeted, as if not sure how to proceed. He turned, partly. I stayed still, only noticing his eyes were still closed. He turned fully, came to me, and opened his eyes.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Oh, I said. And I'm sure my hand involuntarily came up to my lip, as one does naturally to cover the unarticulated gasp. And then, realizing this, I immediately brought my hand back down so as not to scare him. He had always been a nervous person, and to me at least, unduly sensitive to physical ailments. And this one looked, frankly, terrible. All I saw were his eyes, and I wish I'd been more observant to understand fully the expression he was conveying. I'm thinking of the euphemistic descriptions I first thought up. Both of his eyes were puffy, dewy, and swollen. That's what I imagined telling him if he asked, prepared to hear him telling me his eyes were burning or he was having trouble seeing. Yes, your eyes look swollen, a bit puffy. Then I'd trail off, trying to get him calm and get him to a hospital right away without allowing him to obsess in the mirror. His eyeballs looked like peeled lychee, an off-whitish pink, translucent and glossy, with wrinkles and folds I was not accustomed to, and generally appearing more globular and fuller, as if there was more eye mass than usual in his sockets. When he blinked, I wondered if his eyes fully closed, or if some part of that enlarged, moistened flesh prevented his lid from making complete contact in their coverage. That lychee description was perfect, really, because it captured the red seed, too. Inside a lychee is a red seed which looks like a hardened kidney bean. And behind both irises, I saw a faint, dull, red, nubby protrusion that looked somehow too neat and orderly to be a cyst or other normal inflammation. That sounds terrible, I know. It was terrible. It was.
Just stay here with me for a bit,
he said. A cordial request. This was when I first noticed his strange calm. Dear, listen to me. We need to go to a hospital immediately. I'll drive us. Just stay calm. I'm sure it's just an infection. Can you see? At that last question, he smiled. The smile of an inside joke. I'd seen it before. Someone says something that brings to mind something else, and you smile to yourself and think that it's not worth the effort to explain. That's something just for me. That smile excluded me, and seemed especially inconsiderate given that I was trying to help. But I fastened my mind on this being an emergency, and how it's important to keep your cool. Let him just consider that improper smile as creating a big IOU. I'll get to pick the dinners for the next month, and I could eat as many fucking Feinstein's cookies as I damn well pleased. And behind those thoughts, I chastened myself because I loved this man. A mistake, because it was when I thought about how much I loved him and so desperately wanted him to be okay and safe, and for this medical anomaly to be over and behind us, that I began to freak out, focusing on the logistics and even my petty feelings about being hurt by his inside joke smile. Let me concentrate on something other than the panic fomenting inside me. Here was my husband, my companion and father of my children, with bloated eyes.
Dear, I want to stay here. It's okay. Let me explain. This isn't bad news, okay? This is, in fact, quite good.
And he took my right hand and rubbed it between both of his hands. I shook my head as he spoke, not so much in disbelief as for waiting for my opportunity to interject and disabuse him of this, whatever it was. As I heard him out, I almost gagged on my next revelation, felt it as a physical obstruction down through my throat into my chest. This inflammation must have affected his brain because what he said made no rational sense.
I wanted this to happen, dear. This is what I've always wanted. What I've been waiting for my whole life. Dear, I can't cry now, but if I could, I would.
What on earth are you talking about? Please, look at yourself. We need to take you to a hospital. I'm going to call 911. It was becoming difficult to look at him. I could imagine him being mugged and in the recuperation process, left with these jellied eyes.
Don't do that, please. Just let me get all this out. I can't say much, but soon I'll be gone. And I don't mean deceased, honey.
He tightened his grip on my hand to emphasize this point.
I just mean I'll be off in a better place.
You owe me an explanation. A real explanation right now.
Just please sit here with me.
I'm fucking starving. I was shaky and struck with that weightless, dizzying feeling that comes from low blood pressure. Forgive me, but I've always been insecure about saying when I'm hungry, since I'm overweight and still not used to that. I still hold on to that childlike notion that an overweight person would burn through their stored fat before becoming hungry again. I got a hold of myself and explained. I'm hungry, dear. I want to make a shake and I need coffee. I can make some for you too. Then we'll continue talking. I could tell he didn't want me to go, but smiled and said sure, as if he was indulging me out of remembered fidelity. I was sure somehow that, after breakfast and coffee, he would come to his senses and allow me to take him to a hospital. There was no house phone. Instead, we each had a cell. Mine was still charging in our bedroom, and I assume his was in the bedroom as well. If he wouldn't let me call the hospital, then I'd first call 911. Than our daughters. I didn't care what he had to say on the matter. I should have demanded he call 911 just then, but I was famished and my head was already beginning to hurt. That type of headache where your eyes burn and your temples pound and your solid thoughts break apart into fragments and a great cloud seems to hide from you the next point you were going to make. Miraculously, I made the shakes as usual and could pretend this was just any other weekend morning in our kitchen. I called out to him a few times, asked if he was okay, and he responded affirmatively each time in that upturned, doing great voice we use to let each other know that the other person is perfectly contented being alone in the other room. No offense implied. I wanted to get back to him quickly, so I didn't make any coffee. I came back to the bedroom, and he was lying on his back, smiling, eyes closed, face widened and contorted as if he'd been crying tears of happiness, although, of course, there were no tears to be found. I returned with our shakes, which he sipped and cooed.
I can taste the bananas.
I had used extra bananas and peanut butter, which were his favorites. I'd stopped using pineapple and blueberries because those were acidic fruits, which aren't good for our stomach conditions, and remembering that bit of marital logistics made me extremely depressed and heartbroken. We had shared responsibilities. We had shared customs and etiquette. We had shared jokes and references. We had, basically, a life together. Our own universe as husband and wife. And now this. This was more than an eye infection. This was, I was beginning to understand, some act of betrayal. And somehow even worse, an act of betrayal that wasn't even being recognized as such. The taste of the shake seemed to be making him nostalgic, as if he really believed he was drinking my shake for the last time. You owe me an explanation.
You're right, I know you're right.
And putting the shake aside, rolled over onto the pillow for a moment. With his eyes covered, he appeared absolutely normal. And he turned back over, seeming to gather his strength. If this was truly the beginning of some miraculous new development in his life, then I was the obstacle in the way. And I could read that conflict in his reactions, the elation in the waiting. If only he could move beyond this present remorse.
I can't say much, only that I'm sorry. I've waited my whole life for this. I've studied and researched. I've worked for this, if you can believe it. I've worked for it. Long nights of study and research and...
The streak of defensive pride that he'd been building was quickly smoothed out by self-deprecation.
And prayed, even. Yes, me. Praying, I know. Hard to believe. But I prayed for this, which is, trust me, especially ironic. I'm being taken to a better place. This is a sign. The narrowing of the senses, it's called.
I was shaking my head, visibly fuming, hoping my expressed disgust would correct the situation. In our marriage, it didn't matter who was right or wrong. Whenever one party became visibly distressed or angry, the other would become more accommodating and deferential, just to allay the situation and make peace. Because marriage is a partnership, and it's better for the partnership to function rather than for someone to be right. Not only was I furious, but I had the added benefit of actually being right, and my performative anger only served to make me even more legitimately angry. One thing I realized, though, Robert's explanation seemed too detailed to be complete derangement. I had to approach this as something that he believed was credible. What is this? You have a family! Think of our children! And what am I supposed to do? My goal was to get him to come to his senses, to go with me to a hospital, and even more importantly, to acknowledge that he was somehow wrong in all of this, that everything would be fine, and we would resume the course of our lives. Robert, sneaking around, studying and working and praying for what exactly? Some crazy cult beliefs? And when was he doing this exactly? And how had I never known about this? For all I knew, he might have been laid off from work years ago and we'd been paying our bills off savings. And he what? Skulked around libraries and went off to meet fake gurus who fed him mumbo jumbo?
And I'm very sorry. I'm truly sorry. This, if this makes any sense or means anything to you... You are the absolute love of my life. This all began before I'd ever even met you. And I know that's no excuse to you, but I cannot explain to you what this means to me. You're the absolute love of my life. But this is beyond life. Before I even say this, I know how it's going to sound. But it's like at the end of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when Richard Dreyfuss just has to go on the alien ship and explore other worlds. And here, I'm dying on the inside. This has been so, so hard for me. I almost wish this miracle never happened, because I know what I'm going to have to give up. And I thought it would be easier, but it's terrible, a terrible sacrifice. And I will miss you so, so much.
And I could tell he was crying without tears now, heaving and pathetic and desperate, and I wanted to hug him and console him and stop the suffering, to tell him I understood, even if I didn't. I thought, perhaps, to consider him as if he had a terminal illness and just provide palliative love. And maybe, in a sense, he did have a terminal illness. So I hugged him, and he hugged me back, tightly and devoutly. Before we'd embraced, I looked into those swollen eyes and my stomach turned. Because in all this drama, I'd forgotten what pain he must have been in. No person could comfortably have rubbery eyes like that and still have their wits about them. Honey, we both didn't like that movie, remember? It's boring.
True.
And honey, if I remember correctly, didn't Steven Spielberg say he regretted that ending? I believe he wrote that before he had a family of his own. I kind of remember reading that somewhere. We'd both found the movie so treacly and dull and wondered what the hell the fuss was all about.
True, but...
Now, honey, this isn't a movie. We can write our own endings. Don't you understand? There's nothing that can't be fixed, okay? To this, he didn't respond, and I wish I could see his face as it rested on my shoulder. Was he coming to his senses? Now, I'm going to take you to the hospital, okay? Don't you want to... Let's assume what you're saying is true about all the work and studying and praying you've done. Wouldn't you want to know whether it's actually true? Whether what you think is going to happen is actually going to happen? Well, if we go to the doctors and they tell you that you just have, I don't know, some kind of conjunctivitis, then, well, that's something that's important to know, isn't it?
No, dear, I have to remain right here by this window. I bet that in less than a day I'll be gone, or unable to move anyway.
Okay, well, how do you think that sounds to me? Imagine you were me and you heard that. How would that make you feel?
I don't disagree with the point you're making,
he said, and I could hear a hint of exasperation. It's morbidly funny if you think about it. He might be thinking his head off to his version of heaven in the next 24 hours, but, well, not yet. There may be no sighing in heaven, but there definitely was in this bedroom.
But this is something I can only do alone. If you've ever needed to trust, believe, and love me, then this is the time. This is the time.
I'm not going to let you stay here for a day, okay? I'm not going to let you because I love you. Do you understand? Look, maybe you are right, okay? And then I won't feel silly when I come back here and you've been taken away by a magic sunbeam. But until that happens, you're my roly-poly and I'm your hug-a-lump. And you can call me a hug-a-lump even though now we're both fat and our youthful nicknames don't sound so cute anymore.
Not like roly-poly sounds flattering to me either.
Exactly. And we'll still watch our movies and read our books and eat our healthy foods and you'll indulge me sometimes with antique shopping. And we'll have Thanksgiving with the girls and you'll be around to become a grandfather one day. And we can resume bargaining over what type of dog we might get.
That sounds nice, dear. It does sound nice. But I won't be going to any hospital. And I can't have you calling 911.
I gracefully separated from him, still next to him on the bed. Then I stood up, feeling his eyes on me, even under all that bloated, engorged flesh. He watched me as I went to the opposite side of the bed, also known as my side of the bed, the side closer to the door and where my cell phone was charging on the night table.
Honey,
he pleaded. I'm not doing anything yet, honey. Now, please, will you come with me? We can take you to the emergency room at Mercy Hospital. It's only 20 minutes away at most. We'd gone there for every operation. Most recently, his hernia surgery a few years back. Or, if you prefer, we can call Dr. Harmon. I believe you have his cell phone number, right? Dr. Harmon had been our ophthalmologist for over a decade, and we'd seen him annually ever since I was diagnosed with prediabetes.
I can't, honey. For all that is good and just and pure in this world, just please, please, please indulge me and let me stay here for the next day. And stay with me, please. I want you to stay with me. Just please, let me enjoy this day with you, and you with me.
And there isn't much to say except for what you already know. I couldn't take that as an answer, which he understood. He had his senses about him, and you know that. And you know what happened next. I've explained it enough times. He wouldn't let me get to my phone, and he tried to restrain me without hurting me. And I tried to simply make enough space for myself to use my phone without hurting him. He perhaps thought that any sign of physical aggression from him would keep me from calling. I can honestly say I'd never seen that side of him through all our years of marriage. I'm still not convinced he even had that side to him, which is why his whole attempt at physical intimidation was so toothless and ineffective. Maybe he thought that I would just give him that one day, and if he was still there in 24 hours, and by there I mean physically there, not transcended or morphed or whatever he thought he might be doing, then he would realize his error, relent, and go to the hospital. But I wouldn't allow myself to sit in silence and allow my husband to suffer, so I insisted. As he was coming toward me, all lumbering and uncoordinated, I darted out my free hand only to defend myself. I freaked out when my aim proved wrong, and my outstretched fingers should have made contact with his eyes. Should have.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
I've explained that part too, enough times, and maybe I was more convincing the first time I explained it. You can only be told you're wrong so many times before you lose all enthusiasm to explain yourself. So don't be offended if I don't give it my all. Go ask my daughters. They believed me, at least the first time. Do you ever think, why would I volunteer that detail about how my fingers should have touched his eyes? How would it benefit me to say something that sounds so crazy that no one believes me? But, yes, as I said, should have made contact with his eyes. The hardened red seeds protruded further out. The slick, rubbery flesh withdrew defensively. Or, putting it another way, his eyes contracted. None of that has to do with how he died. I stabbed him. You know that. Things escalated, and I stabbed him with a kitchen knife. He did everything in his power to stop me, and I defended myself. I'll leave it at that, because saying anything more is going to make me vomit and weep. I'm not even being accused of murdering him. The 911 operator heard enough to vindicate me. It's always about the eyes. That's what it's about. And the worst thing, I wish what he'd been saying was true. You know that his brain has been studied, and they tell me there was nothing wrong with it. At least, nothing they could see in an autopsy. So maybe he was in his right mind. I wish I could say that when he fell, helplessly and pathetically, as you'd expect an overweight, unathletic, middle-aged man who never played a sport in his life, there'd been some giant omen, some corroboration of what he'd been saying, like the thunderclap of an anguished god. And I can't help but think that it was my fault. That I was too prideful just to let him be. I know, stupid. But that was my husband, and the father of my children. Maybe in some alternative universe, I could have given him his final day, and I'd leave, and I'd come back to find him gone. And it wouldn't be hard to explain that. People are ready to accept a middle-aged man disappearing from his family for any number of understandable reasons. I tell people I always suspected something, some other woman, or more painfully but more credibly, some exhaustion, depression, and dissatisfaction that he just couldn't deal with anymore. That becomes more believable with each decrepit year. That's what I'd say if he disappeared. But each night I'd look out that window contemplatively, up toward the sky. Even though I had no reason to believe he'd disappeared northward, but isn't that comforting to think? And I do it so often, and afraid it was such significance that I'd start to believe it myself. I'd convince myself that my darling Robert had fulfilled whatever mission it was that he'd set out for himself, and disappeared into some sublime satisfaction. Instead, there's a body. And they'll come up with some way to describe his eyes.
That was No Hole in a Small World Can Truly Be a Small Hole, written by J.R. Hamanthashin, performed by Olivia Steele, and featuring Jeff Sturtevant. A heartbreaking reminder that even the people we know best might be carrying secrets too strange to explain and too personal to share. Did Robert find what he was waiting for? Was he ascending to something greater or slowly unraveling? And if someone you loved asked you to give them just one day to disappear on their own terms, could you allow it? If tonight's story left you chilled or deeply moved, you're not alone. Hamanthashin's work has been described as a cross between Lovecraft and Chuck Palahniuk, and for good reason. If tonight's tale left you wondering what's real and what lives just beyond the edges of grief, help us keep these shadows moving by supporting Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Leave us a 5-star review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. Watching on YouTube, like, comment, and subscribe. It's the best way to keep these nightmares whispering in your ears. And now, as promised, more about tonight's featured publisher, Velox Books. At Velox Books, they're passionate about bringing the most chilling, weird, and captivating horror stories to readers who crave the extraordinary. With over a decade of independent publishing experience, they specialize in collections of horror, weird fiction, and dark psychological tales that push the boundaries of imagination. If tonight's story unsettled you, you'll want to dive into You Shall Never Know Security by J.R. Hamanthashin, available now on Amazon.com for as little as $4.99. This 2023 release is a masterclass in cosmic and psychological horror, featuring stories that explore everything from quiet despair to existential dread. The collection has earned praise from critics across the world. Kirkus Reviews called it, quote, a twisted, uneasy, satisfying book, unquote. Horror DNA praised it as, quote, beautifully written and compelling as hell, unquote. And Ginger Nuts of Horror described it as, quote, a rare and sincere joy, Lovecraftian fiction at its finest, unquote. If you enjoy stories that burrow under your skin, that linger long after the last page, Hamantaschen delivers. His fiction speaks to the part of us that suspects deep down that life itself is the real horror. Visit VeloxBooks.com or search You Shall Never Know Security on Amazon to grab your copy today and enter a world where no truth is comforting and no fear is misplaced. And don't forget, if you want more audio horror like this, become a patron at ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com. Just $7.99 a month or less with an annual plan gets you ad-free episodes, exclusive content, and early access to each new tale. Join us on Facebook, Instagram, and X to let us know what your thoughts are of tonight's story. Would you have given Robert one last day or done what had to be done? I'm Steve Taylor, and as always, it's been my pleasure guiding you through another journey into the dark. Join us again this Wednesday for more nightmares. Until then, turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Sweet dreams, listener. Sweet dreams.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.